Randall Kennedy is with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula, Bill Russell.
Richard Rodriguez sat more or less where you're sitting a while back. Richard Rodriguez, commentator, the media subject was a book he wrote called Brown, mm-hmm. that you're probably familiar with. But one of the things he said, both in the book and in talking with him, is that one of the things this country has to do is to address the love and sex, and love and sex in all of its manifestations, and that we have not done that. And lo and behold, you've done it. And other people seem to be beginning to address this, which I think you would argue, and it certainly seems to me, is a sign of progress, is a sign that perhaps the society is getting a little more healthy.
I think it's a very deep subject, this question of interracial intimacy, though it has been a repressed subject. The extent to which we are already a multiracial society has been repressed. People talk about, well, we're becoming a multiracial society.
No,
we've been a multiracial society.
300 years, more or less.
With all sorts of mixing. And indeed, in my books, I talk mainly about white-black. But of course, it's so much more, it's more complicated than that. You talk about Native Americans, you bring in people from various countries in Asia. We are already a thoroughly intermixed society. It's just that we've kidded ourselves, hidden it from ourselves. We've tried to simplify life through the use of terms like the Crayola, crayon. So we talk about white, black, though, of course, we're already intermixed to a very large degree.
Your colleague, Orlando Patterson, I think, started me off down this trail years ago. I sort of have lost track of what race is. I mean, I'm putting words in his mouth, maybe, but, you know, would characterize it as a bogus category. That it's something that was created to serve some arguably nefarious ends. And I find myself, particularly as I was reading this and thinking about Richard Rodriguez's work, I've sort of lost track of what race is and what it means. And, you know, part of that is we hear too much of it, and part of it is we hear too little about it. That is to say, what we hear tends to be simple-minded and predictable. But I help me with this.
Well, and Dr. Patterson takes a position that we shouldn't even talk about it. Talk about ethnicity, but that race doesn't exist, and just make it go away.
Yeah, or Orlando Patterson, who's a colleague and friend, wants very much to change our racial nomenclature. He doesn't like white, black. He prefers Euro-American, African-American. My own view is a little bit different. In my writing, use race in a thoroughly conventional way. When I use race, I'm referring to the way in which people think of the term. It's not that I'm saying that there is such a thing as race. It's simply that whatever, at any particular historical moment, people have considered race to be, that's what I say. Okay, that's what people are talking about with respect to race. It is a term, people should understand, that has changed dramatically over time. Let's take Virginia, for instance. In Virginia, until 1910, you were considered white so long as you were not more than 24% black or colored. And that's a lot different.
Which is to say one grandparent.
That's right.
Well, one less. I mean,
it was a little less than that. You couldn't have a black grandparent, but you could clearly be of discernible African American lineage and still be white in Virginia prior to 1910.
Or a grandparent who was mixed race themselves.
That's right. And in fact, I found it very difficult to figure out this whole question of, you know, 1/16, 1/32nd.
You have to do the family tree and count back.
Absolutely.
And or 1/3, which is even more confusing.
It was incredibly difficult to figure out. But, I mean, the point is, nowadays, I think many people have the feeling that for most of American history, in most jurisdictions, the one-drop rule governed. If you were of any discernible black blood, you were black. Well, it's much more complicated. Again, Virginia, between 1910 and 1924, they went to a different rule. Then it was only in 1924 they went to a one-drop rule. What did that mean? That meant that in 1900, you could be white legally in Virginia. In 1925, you would be colored legally in Virginia. In 1924, when they were in they were debating in Virginia the Racial Integrity Act of 1924, there was a legislator who got up and said, if we keep messing around with this, there won't be any white people left in Virginia. And that was because the whole question of what is white was being narrowed and narrowed and narrowed. And he was recognizing that, of course, there had been a lot of interracial intimacy, a lot of interracial mixing in Virginia. He was aware of that. And he was saying two things. He was saying, number one, the reality is there's been a lot of interracial mixing. And number two, the whole conception of what is white, what is black, is something that we make up.
Well, just for my comfort, I know that you're a lawyer and not a biologist, but for my comfort, let us say, this is all fantasy. There is no such thing as black or white blood.
Well, and biologists and other scientists have been saying that ever since the end of World War II.
Well, they've been saying it a lot longer than that.
Probably.
Looking at Darwin, for instance, who says, you're a species, end of subject.
Well, and there's where it's not like I know a lot about science. I credit what scientists have said, especially with the Human Genome Project. We're learning more and more about the human species all the time, recognizing increasingly that these surface variations are truly just surface variations. The thing is that perception matters hugely. And so even if the scientists say one thing, the fact of the matter is on the ground, millions and millions and millions of people think in racial categories. And so their perception of racial categories has its own independent power.
Before we go too far from that, not only is race a subject, but you also talk about intimacy.
Yes.
Now, intimacy, immediately, I think, sex.
Mm-hmm.
But you say it's a whole lot more than that. You say sex, marriage, identity, adoption.
Yes, I would add to that friendship.
That takes it out of the, lascivious, and puts it into life.
One of the points I made in my class, because after that episode where the class really just shut up, I kept coming back in the following weeks, and I prodded, and I said, you know, this was a course on race relations law. We spent a good month talking about race relations and the employment relationship. It's a very important subject. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases. And we go through the law governing race relations at the workplace. I said, if you think about if you think about friendship and marriage, those relationships are at least, if not more important than the workplace relationship. But we don't think about it. We don't talk about it. If you think about friendship, dating, marriage, how do people get jobs? How do people learn about the world? How do people rise in the world? What are information networks made of? Intimate relationships as a practical matter are incredibly important, but we don't think about them.
What surprised me in reading in Interracial Intimacies was we don't think about it, but there's a lot of law around it.
Oh, absolutely. One of the most fun things in writing this book was reading about cases which have been lost. So, for instance, and now I teach contracts. That's one of my courses. Every time I teach contracts now, I bring in a case that I came across in researching my book on interracial intimacy. It's a Massachusetts case. This is what happened. A white man proposed marriage to a white woman. They were going to get married in 6 months. He proposes marriage, she accepts. He learns in the interim that her parents are, quote, colored. When he learns this, he withdraws his invitation to marry.
Which is a contract.
That's right. She sued him for breach of promise to marry. She got a big jury verdict. He appealed, and one of his grounds for appeal was that she should have known that it would be important to him, her racial lineage. And so he argued that she ought to have spoken about that. He argued that she was under a duty to share that information with him. The Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts disagreed on that point and said, no, caveat emptor, buyer beware. If this was so important to him, he should have asked the question. Well, I talk about that in my class, and we have a wonderful discussion. Because I think there's a strong argument on the other side. I mean, after all, this is not a used car transaction. You could argue that in so much as this was they were on the cusp of being married, didn't she have more than the usual obligation? She didn't only have an obligation of honesty, didn't she have an obligation of candor? And so that gets into all sorts of issues about, well, just suppose somebody at some point was a male instead of a female. Does that person have an obligation to disclose that fact? Or do you have an obligation to disclose your prior sex life? And we have wonderful discussions, but at a point in America, there was a time in American history where this sort of issue, the whole question, for instance, of whether somebody is white or somebody's, how do you tell?
And I'm sure you'll give us the answer when we come back in just a moment.
You hire an expert, right?
Wait. We can prod and poke in a moment when we return with the Paula Gordon Show. Randall Kennedy is our guest. Please be with us when Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, and Randall Kennedy all return.